is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Thanks for joining us today. Hollywood actress Lupita Nyong'o recently opened up about having what she called a complicated relationship with the way she speaks. Lupita, who was born in Mexico, raised in Nairobi and lived in America, said that she had earlier embraced her Kenyan accent or African accent as a student in Massachusetts, but that she later started using an American accent when she joined the Yale School of Drama to pursue acting. Lupita explained that she dropped her Kenyan accent because she did not know very many people in movies and television with Kenyan accents. There was just no market for that, she says. Entertainment analysts say that African actors like Lupita Nyong'o often face significant challenges when breaking into Hollywood, which has historically been dominated by Western narratives and standards. This has often led to limited roles for actors with African accents, forcing many to adopt American or British accents to be considered for a wider range of roles. Kenyan actress and commentator Joy Muthengi, who lived and worked in the United States before returning home to Kenya 15 years ago, tells me that Lupita Nyong'o's decision to reclaim her Kenyan accent signals the potential for change, where African actors can be seen and heard authentically without having to compromise their identity to fit industry norms. This evolution, she says, is allowing African actors not only to break into Hollywood, but to also thrive while maintaining their cultural identity. I reached her in Nairobi. I wanted to ask you, as an actress who lived and studied in America, did you face
Similar
pressure regarding your accent when you were navigating professional spaces here in the US, or whether it's a school or professional spaces?
You know, first of all, I want to say this was a very powerful message and conversation when it's coming from an Oscar winner such as Lupita. Like, I found this so powerful that she was talking about this. Because, yes, she was born in Mexico City. You know, she's got Kenyan parents. She's lived in the U.S. She's lived in Kenya and acted and, you know, studied in both. And so I thought it was a very important conversation to come up. For me, most of my media success did not come until I was back in Kenya. So in the U.S., I was mostly studying and doing a little bit of work, but not much. And I didn't think the accent thing was a big deal until I came back to Kenya and I got on radio and everyone was like, huh? You need to tone it down, you know? And I was kind of like,
To tone my accent down.
It was too much. And at first I got offended. I was like, what are you talking about? This is how I talk. This is just me. But then I came to understand, you know, there really is like a duality to all of this and living in different places. And, you know, adapting their culture and then, you know, moving to, you know, another place and you still call that home. It's a confusing place. And I really liked what Lupita's mom told her, that it's just a representation of your life. It can change. Your life has changed. You've grown up in different places. You've had different experiences and experienced different cultures. Mm. And it's a combination of who you are. And I thought that's just really beautiful for people to sort of embrace the whole 360 of who you are. Like, this is who I am. This is where I've been. This is the people I've interacted with. But then another thought, which might sound funny, but when I was in the U.S., you know, I had African-American friends also, and they had what they called their corporate accent. And this is what I thought of. when Lupita talked about this, I was kind of like, oh, it's kind of like having your corporate accent.
It's like, you know, what they call it.
Yeah, exactly. So you talk one way with your friends and with your family, you go to work and you're like, hello, this is Joey. You've reached blah, 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 blah. How may I help you today? You
right,
know?
Right. You don't want to bring your African accent to American corporate space.
Yes. You want to be acceptable to the people around you. You want to make them comfortable. You want to feel like them to feel like, you know, we are all one. But it's a unique experience.
I knew this would totally resonate with you in so many ways. So yeah, thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this: in your opinion, how important is accent authenticity for African actors who are trying to break into global industries like Hollywood? Does it limit opportunities, or is the landscape starting to shift?
I think we had the understanding that we had to conform in order to be accepted for a very long time. Like, that was our understanding. It's like, if we go to this new world, we have to adapt as much as possible because we look different. We're from different backgrounds, but can we at least talk like them? But I feel like there's a real uniqueness in our voices and in, you know, the countries and the continents that we represent. And I think Hollywood has started to embrace people for who they are. And it does make you, I think, a better actress or actor if you're able to, you know, we see like people from the UK coming to the US and getting US accents in movies and film and TV and stuff like that. And it's, yeah, exactly. It's part of the job. Right. So I don't think you leave that part of you behind. I think it's important for people to know where you come from and who you are and what experiences and cultures have shaped you. But I think the whole kind of switching back and forth, I think it's more acceptable now for you not to try and be something you're not. Absolutely. But if it's for an acting role, I think it's acceptable to kind of, you know, fit into whatever dynamic and whatever role you're trying to fit into. Exactly. That's your job. Now, that's your job.
Lupita says that she mentioned that there were no markets. There was no market for actors with Kenyan accents when she started out. Do you think that is changing now? Have you noticed a growing acceptance of diverse African voices in global entertainment now that we have?
I can say, and I hope this trend continues to grow. And I have noticed it because I'm an avid watcher of film and TV. Mm. And when I find, you know, people of color acting in African roles, and I can tell the accents are not really African. It's like they're trying so hard to be African, and I'm like, where are the Africans? You just call us Africans.
Generic Hollywood.
That bothers me so much. And so I hope there is, you know, more of a call to have the people cast who are more, you know, authentically African and authentically, you know, Caribbean or whatever accents that they're looking for, that they just go look for those people. Those people exist. And if they're given the chance, then they're able to step onto that platform and showcase their work.
Now, as an actress yourself with both Kenyan and international contexts, how... Mm-hmm. Do you balance, or how do you, how were you able to balance maintaining your cultural authenticity as a Kenyan while working in spaces that often prioritize a more westernized narrative of, you know, how you should sound or what?
I think, you know, as in anything in life, you can only fake something for so long. Eventually, people are going to discover who you are. They're going to discover who you really are. You can't keep up a facade forever.
Yeah.
When, you know, in any type of work experience, people will come to understand, okay, this is what who this person actually is, and not just what they've been trying to show us. Mm-hmm. So for me, I think it's important for me to show that straight off the bat. This is who I am. This is where I come from. These are the experiences I'm bringing. But, you know, since this is acting and, you know, this is who you need me to be for this role, I'll be that person. But as soon as, you know, we're done with this script, I'm going back to me. And I'm going back to my authenticity and who I am. So I feel like, you know, people shouldn't carry around that weight of feeling like I have to be as much, you know, American or Euro as these other people, because you're not that. Just be who you are and embrace who you are. And because that's going to come out eventually.
Now, I remember you speaking exactly the way you speak right now. You maintain the same accent. I don't know whether it is an American accent or a Kenyan accent.
It's a something accent. You know what? Thank you, Jackson, because when I was reading, you know, up about Lupita, she said that people asked her, so what is this accent? And she said, this is Lupita. And I said, exactly, this is me. It's Joey. You can tell I'm from somewhere. You might have to ask me where. You can tell I've been maybe to America, maybe to the UK. It doesn't matter. This is me.
You're a child of the world, a global citizen.
I'm a child of the world. Hallelujah.
Do you think African representation in Hollywood and the global industry is changing? Would you like to see?
I would like to see more East African. I feel like we see a lot of, you know, West African representatives in Hollywood, and that's fantastic just for us, for them to be able to showcase our heritage and our culture. But let me tell you, the moment when Lupita won that Oscar and she said, my dreams are valid, it spoke to me directly. And I think it spoke to every young East African aspiring actress or filmmaker, or, you know, showing them that they can go from these spaces that we know on our local televisions and whatnot, and, you know, eventually go into Hollywood looking like exactly who they are and being exactly who they are and make it to that level of a stage. So I would love to see more young Lupitas. And I think that's what she's trying to do with her new podcast, is to just, you know, tell our stories and have more representation out there.
Beautifully said. Thank you so much, Joey. I appreciate you. And now I'm going to let you go to a networking event that where you're going to
thank you.
Speak with your American Kenyan fusion accent, or your Joey, so to say.
I got this.
That was Kenyan actress and commentator Joey Muthengi. I reached her in Nairobi, Kenya. You're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Girls are good in science, so we just need to change that mindset of boys being the best in town. And then there are some doctors who are around, and there are female doctors. Those doctors should be coming out, speaking in public, telling girls that they have done it, and they can also do it in school. Yeah, the doctors who are female should be role model. And they should be informing the other girls who are in schools that science is good for them and they can do well.
What should be done is to encourage girls to take science subjects? I think first of all begins at home. Parents should be educated. They should be taught how, you know, to involve the girls, and let me say generally the children, to teach them some things at home. Sometimes they fear the science subjects, because science, normally when you talk about it, it is more to do with, you know, the reproductive organs and other things with the human being. That is what normally goes to your mind.
Now, the thing is like this, you know, we girls actually, we tend sometimes to branch away from the science subjects. When you try to look at the nurses and the doctors we have around there, majority are men. So what I want to say, and maybe what can encourage them to do science, is are the teachers themselves at school.
Yeah, Blessed Barack just cruising through Washington. Tune into the Upfront Show, presented by Jackson from out of Washington. And yeah, it's well informative, and you better know that.
Research shows that Africa's creative economy has emerged as a key driver of economic transformation, growth, and development by leveraging the continent's rich cultural heritage, arts, and innovation to generate wealth and create opportunities for young people. However, analysts say that for Africa's creative economy to reach its full potential, challenges such as intellectual property protection, access to financing, and infrastructure limitations must be addressed. Sankara Byaruhanga, an alumni of the Mandela Washington Fellowship, heads a creative hub in Uganda. His goal is to help with the marketing of creative ideas by startups in East Africa. He joined me in studio.
Talk to us about Creative Campus. You leverage technology for economic growth and youth empowerment.
Yes.
What inspired you to co-found this initiative, and how has it evolved over the years?
Okay, so the trigger starts at a university, Mbarara University of Science and Technology, one of the biggest universities, actually the second in Uganda, but, you know, almost the only one in the region when it comes to science and technology. In the computing faculty, for instance, a survey indicated that from 2013 to 2020, out of close to 3,000 research projects that were made in the computing side, with prototypes being developed by young people, only one was on the market already, like saving people as a community solution. And definitely that is alarming. So when you go back to what it looks like in Uganda, quite a number of hubs, quite a number of organizations that are so much into skilling young people. But if you go back to the young people, the question is, how do I get to the market? I have the skill, finally, I can be able to produce a song or anything, but how do I get to the market? So we came on board to close that gap, to say, yes, you can be able to commercialize what you have already created or what you are able to create. Mm-hmm. So we then champion commercialization among young people, not only just in southwestern Uganda, but Uganda and beyond.
In what ways do you think technology and innovation can drive economic growth and development and empowerment in East Africa?
Yeah, so we need to look at the numbers. For instance, Uganda itself, with over 80% of its population being, you know, below the age of 35, all those are young people hooked to smartphones, hooked to tech. Definitely there is potential because users are actually there. And therefore, so from processes to, you know, e-governance to making, you know, a lot of work easy with the whole revolution of, for instance, artificial intelligence, you have an opportunity to make it easy. I can give you an example. Uganda has, I think, the doctor ratio with 1 to close to 2,000 patients. And because of that, medical interns are being deployed to, you know, health centers. That definitely is a gap because they are attending to patients. It means they are already outnumbered. But AI says, I am not here to be a doctor, but I can be able to help you. As you interview Sankara, who is a patient, I can be able to put together the, you know, the medical
metrics and exactly, the information,
the report, that, yeah, yes, yeah. For instance, so quick so that you don't have to waste time. Mm-hmm. But also, if you're meeting Sankara who only speaks Swahili, you as a doctor who understands Swahili, me as AI, I can be able to help you, mm-hmm. you know, communicate with this patient, and that makes, you know, the work efficient. So definitely, tech has potential.
Mm.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about how you started in this. What sparked your interest into getting into the tech and innovation space?
Yeah, so like I had earlier noted, noting that I did information technology myself, and before you graduate, you need to, you know, present a well-researched project. You don't stop at that. You must present a prototype, a working prototype to the solution. Mm-hmm. And what happens? We leave them in the shelves at the university and then go back to look for jobs. So one thing, I have a father who is telling me, you're doing IT and you're only getting to the streets to, you know, to be, you know, a repair TVs. That was the perception.
The perception is,
yeah,
that
exactly.
You're doing the low tech jobs.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Mm. But I'm like, you man, I have a prototype that I've left at the university that works well. How come I am not able to, you know, earn from it?
Mm.
And just like that. So when we sampled...
And part of your research is to show that it has earning potential, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because as long as something is going to be able to solve someone's problem, then there is a reason enough for that person to pay for it,
yeah.
or for it to be able to create some more employment opportunities. So once we documented that very one and submitted, we received funding from Afrinic and we were able to set up this hub. And I can tell you that, for instance, in the last 1 year, we've had six tech startups in my region alone that are on the market working already.
That went through you.
Exactly. Mm. Yes. And those are being commercialized. Mm. So that was really the trigger.
Absolutely. So as a Mandela Washington Fellow, now alumni, what are some of the specific commercialization lessons that you're looking to implement when you go back to Uganda?
Okay, as a hub, one of them, I would tell you, America is the only implementer of the SBDC model, the Small Business Development Center model, and our governments have no clue about this. But you can see a developed country like America supports each state. Each state has an SBDC. That is one. Now, policy-wise, the leader, the advocacy side of myself is to advocate for SBDCs for Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to back to ideas like you asked, I was challenged with simple systems in the USA. For instance, I want to cut my hair, and it is as easy as visit. I won't mention the platforms, but at least there are quite a number of them. Mm-hmm. Visit them, book a session with a barber, walk in at a time that you have, you know, agreed upon. They work you professionally and what you expect. What happens in Uganda is move into a saloon at any time, wait. Mm. You're not sure if they're actually going to deliver the best results. And then you're also killing time. So, for instance, what I'm taking back to Uganda as one of the ideas is a mobile application where saloons sign up and Ugandans have an opportunity to decide, I am going to be able to go to a barber at this time and it is scheduled, they are expecting me. And just like
that's
that,
a great idea.
The saloon man is happy, and we are also taking back our commission, but also the customer is happy. So we have a number of those ideas that we're taking back.
What are some of the challenges to commercialization of these type of ideas?
Okay, so it goes to understanding, number one, the business model of the idea. Does it really make the business sense? Who has your money of what you have created or what you really think you should create? And how basically are you going to enter the market? What does it take? So the certification, be it the marketing strategy, be it, and the business sense, the core business sense, one being able to capitalize on their value proposition is actually the core of, you know, commercialization. Mm.
Thank you so much, Sankara Byaruhanga. I appreciate you coming through.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The documentary Feast Your Ears, the story of WHFS 102.3 FM, chronicles the rise and cultural impact of one of the most eclectic and influential radio stations in American history. Jay Scholzberg, the executive producer for the documentary, briefly worked at the station when he was only 17 years old. He tells me that from its humble beginnings in the town of Bethesda in Maryland, WHFS became a sanctuary for music lovers and a launching pad for legendary artists and bands during the 1970s and the 1980s. He joins me to talk about it.
Jay, thank you so much for joining us today. I wanted to start off by asking you to share your own personal connection to WHFS 102.3 FM, if any connection, and how this influenced your approach to the film.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. My connection goes back to me being a teenager in the D.C. area. WHFS 102.3 was in Bethesda, Maryland, which was a very sleepy suburb of Washington in that era. No high-rises. And so it was my station of choice as a teenager. That's where all the new music was. This was not a top 40 station. So this station was playing music you would never hear on top 40 radio. And I was attracted to that at 17 years old, actually the summer of 72. I was actually used to deliver the Washington Post in the mornings and where I lived in Rockville, Maryland. And back in that day, you used to knock on the door to collect your money. You didn't get a bill in the mail. And so one day I knocked on the door and this woman named Susan said, "Hey, come on in, let me get your money." And so she gives me the money and says, "So what are you doing this summer?" I said, "I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing." She said, "Well, I mean for work." And I said, "Well, I think I have a job already, 7 days a week." She said, "No, I know that, but just come down to the Festa. You might like this place. You can come check it out." So I didn't know where I was going. So I went down to the Triangle Towers on Cordell Avenue and went up to the second floor in the glass elevator.
Wait, hold on a second.
And I walked into the main lobby and looked around and went, "Oh, it's a radio station." And there was a glass partition to my left, and I could see the side of a DJ at a control board, but he wasn't talking. So we went through the door, and there was into a bigger area where there were a number of different doors, the library and offices. And I turned around and looked the other way through. So now facing that DJ, there's a door with a glass slot in it, and I could see two people who were facing the DJ through another piece of glass. I said, "Who's that?" And she said, "Oh, that's the DJ Murray the K." And then the person who did the show with him, I can't think of her name right now. And I said, "Murray the K?" She said, "Do you know who he is?" I said, "Well, yes, I grew up in New Jersey. He was a big AM DJ and latched onto the Beatles when they came for their first tour in 1964 and rode on the train with them and got connected. So I'm like, "I'll pay you if I can work here." So they hired me. I was just sort of the courier messenger. "Hey, do this. Hey, clean that," that sort of thing. I didn't last very long, about a month. I was 17. But it was a great experience. I met a couple of the DJs and got interested in radio, and that kind of just sort of set me off to college the next semester. I had one elective and I took radio production. So I kind of learned a little bit about that. And then I kind of went off into being a musician. And kind of left that, but it's just sort of the beginning of that cycle that brought me to this point, because it was so important to me in so many ways. We can get into later, but it boils down to the music, sense of community, the tie-ins to all the places where we want to buy records or a stereo or a waterbed, this is the 70s, or where to get blue jeans, or the local health food store, where did they advertise? HFS. Right. So it was kind of, and also were the nightclubs of that era, the Bayou, Cellar Door, and the Psychedelic, and they're all gone now, but everybody was advertising there. So it was, in a way, linking the community through that. And HFS had vegetarian cookbook in 1975.
Wow.
They had a ride board. Very ahead of the curve.
And that was very progressive.
A ride board, a housing board, a jobs board. And so they really tied into the, they were the center of the whole community, really, not just Bethesda, but the general D.C. area, Montgomery County, P.G. County, D.C., Northern Virginia, whoever could get them. And it was a commercial. It was a commercial station. It wasn't, you know, not a nonprofit or a PBS or NPR type of station or Pacifica station.
So let's talk a little bit about its impact and legacy. Obviously, it had a great impact on your life, you having worked there for a very short period of time as a teenager. But for the community, I'm quite sure, like you were telling me earlier, about when you're showing this movie, the kind of reception it had, the station itself, as I was reading, was known for its eclectic music selection, and it had a very important role in shaping the local and national music scenes. In your opinion, what made WHFS so unique and influential during its time on air?
Well, you really nailed it twice. One is they supported local music big time. So if local musicians had a tape, not even necessarily an album, and the music was good, they'd play it because the music was good and they wanted to support the local musicians. Some of those musicians turned out to be Emmylou Harris, who went on to greater fame, the Nighthawks, who've had their own fame, Nils Lofgren, who had a band here called Grin, but went on to record with Neil Young, and eventually he's in Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band. So a lot of these musicians went on to achieve, you know, national or international fame. So that's one big thing, and supporting local music. The other thing was that they didn't play top 40. They only played music that they were playing breaking new artists. They were playing music by artists who were really unknown at the time. Bonnie Raitt, Little Feat, NRBQ, Taj Mahal, Jackson Brown. There's a whole David Bromberg. There's a long laundry list of musicians who weren't famous yet. For big fame, I believe they played the first 5 Jimmy Buffett albums before he even had a hit.
Wow.
Once he had a hit, they weren't playing the hits. But same thing with even Billy Joel, an album or two. They were playing this stuff because it was new and different and it was good. And that's why they played it. And there was no corporate control. The people that owned the radio station did not have a playlist. It did not force them to play any songs ever. They were able to play what they wanted, when they wanted. Pretty much for whatever
they were intentional in selecting artists that were kind of on a come up, that were less known.
Absolutely.
Right.
What
would you say was the most surprising or interesting discovery that you made during your research for this documentary?
Wow. I can tell you one or two. I can't say which one was the most. Someone who joined the station about 5 years after its inception in late 66, Jake Einstein, two of his sons were DJs on the station, Damien and David. He joined the station, I believe, late 66. There's no date for that, as a salesman. And he got a little part of the station at that point. But he really became with help from other employees there, Patty Ebert, who eventually married her son, Damien, and others. He really did a great job integrating the station into the community.
That was Jess Schlossberg, the director of the documentary Feast Your Ears, the story of WHFS 102.3. And with that, we come to the end of our show today. Many thanks to all of you for tuning in, whether you tuned in online via our website, voaafrica.com, or listened via our FM stations around the world. Remember to connect with us on our social media platforms. We are at VOA Upfront, and we are also at VOA Africa. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead, Africa.